Lights on for safety, 38 degrees Kenosha, 37 in Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And I'm very excited that we can have on the program for part one of today's program a colleague of mine here at Gateway Technical College, which owns and operates Gateway Technical College. Stacy Riley is Vice President for Student Services and Enrollment. And I suspect that is an office that carries with it a plethora of responsibilities, probably a wide array of them. And we're going to be talking in particular today about a very specific initiative that is designed for Gateway to be able to reach out and connect with people who began their education here and then for one reason or another found that education interrupted, maybe stopped in its tracks for one reason or another. And this is an initiative to try to reach out to many of those people and see if they can't return to Gateway and complete their degree. And we'll be talking about that in just a few minutes. Stacy Riley, we welcome you to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. Tell our listeners, first of all, a little bit about yourself in terms of where you're from originally and at what point you became part of the Gateway community.
Sure, would be happy to. So I was born and raised in central Wisconsin on a small family dairy farm. I actually am a first-generation college student and attended Mid-State Technical College, one of our sister colleges up in central Wisconsin. I then had the opportunity to work at Mid-State until coming to Gateway. So I have been within the technical college system for 30 years and have been at Gateway for 12 and a half, working with student services and enrollment.
Wow. I'm just curious about that first gig. What that was like. I bet it was interesting to be a student and then, I'm assuming, fairly soon thereafter, shifting gears and suddenly working with students instead of being one yourself.
It was interesting, and that's when I learned really all the things that I still use today in the work that we do here at Gateway. I spent most of my time in the student services area, so almost probably 25 of my 30 years working with students. Started out as an academic secretary, so learned kind of the back of the house interworkings of our academic work at the technical college system, and did tech prep at the time, so kind of our high school partnerships. I did recruitment, some advising, supported our financial aid office, all of those things to support student success at the college. So still dig back to those roots today to support our students.
Fantastic. And although there's certainly been a through line, of course, in working within the technical college system, I suspect you over the course of 30 years have seen an incredible shift and transformation in terms of what technical college education looks like compared to, for instance, when you were a student.
Definitely. There's been many areas of shifting and evolving, but there's still our mission is the same, right? Supporting our communities that we support with Gateway Technical College, our three counties. Our mission in technical education is really that supporting family supporting wages and careers for those individuals that live and work in our communities.
When was it again you came to Gateway?
12 and a half years ago. So 2010, a very interesting time. to transition to an institution. We were in a recession at the time, if you recall. So had many other challenges, you know, to work through there. And since then, 12 and a half years later, you know, we still are working to support our students and doing the best that we can to serve our community.
I asked you before we went on the air if you have been the vice president for student services and enrollment that whole time. And it sounds like that has not maybe specifically been your title the whole time, that there's been a little bit of shifting and changing over the years. Just give us at least a general sense of that arc.
Sure. I have always supported student services here at Gateway. It's evolved and grown. Most recently, you know, 5 or 6 years ago, we really, as an institution, embraced the concept of, I'll call, enrollment management, or enrollment and how do we best use the information we know about our students and our communities to serve our students in the most beneficial way and help them be successful. So that's one big shift. Additionally, I've assumed responsibility for our academic advising and career and employment services over the years, and really shifting our academic advising work to be proactive, holistic, and relational to really support our students. So that's a couple of the big shifts over the years.
Right. It's interesting. I mean, I date all the way back to 1986. So, I mean, I'm an old fossil here at Gateway. And one of the things that is interesting to think about from my perspective is not only the content of what Gateway offers, how that has dramatically shifted and broadened over the years, and also the kind of the sophistication and polish with which that education is delivered, but also just kind of the physical layout of things, like the area in the other building where students come for financial aid or registration or so on. And once upon a time, that was just kind of a long hallway with a lot of offices that kind of all looked the same and shut off from each other. And now it is transformed into this space that is so kind of warm and inviting and also just sort of interconnected, which makes so much sense.
Yeah, I'm happy to hear you say that, because our goal with remodeling our student services centers was to create a warm, inviting environment. So to hear you say that that's what you feel and how you feel as you walk by or interact with us is amazing. And how we welcome our students to the college and how we serve them, you know, really, really does matter and really is about what we do in the core of student services.
Mm. I'm thinking, this has actually never really crossed my mind before, but my full-time job is teaching over at Carthage, which, of course, while they service, a variety of people, I think it's probably fair to say that our student body at Carthage is a bit more homogeneous in terms of being mostly 18 to 22 year olds. And of course, Gateway is not that at all. There's plenty of people who are in that age group. But of course, one of the beauties of a school like this is you have people at all different stages of life coming to Gateway, sometimes coming to Gateway for the first time well into adult life. And I should think that is an interesting challenge, and maybe also makes some of the work you do even more meaningful. The fact that some Gateway students are 18 years old, right out of high school, maybe even younger, and some are 55-year-olds, maybe you've never been to school before, and everything in between. I mean, wow, for someone involved in the student services area, that's an interesting array of challenges on your plate.
It is an interesting array of challenges. That is a good way to put it, because yes, we do. We service under 18, we have a very strong dual enrollment program with our regional high schools, so a lot of under 18 students. And I actually was just looking, we this last year serviced 197 students that were over 62.
Ah.
So that whole plethora of individuals that come to us for many reasons, we're here to help and support and guide. They're looking for different things. They need different types of support and different types of encouragement along the way. But that's the beauty of the work that we do.
Mm. I also really wanted to circle back to something you said early on in sketching your own story, the fact that you were the first generation of your family to go to college. And that seems to me also to be really something to highlight, because I'm sure part of what you and your colleagues do is also one of your most important assignments would be to properly service those students who have the same story, who come from a home where for whatever reason neither parent has been to college, and this is really a new and unfamiliar sort of adventure.
It is. That we have a lot of first-generation students yet at Gateway, and the needs of those individuals are different. They did not, you know, grow up with that. The language, with the potential encouragement and understanding of the value of post-secondary education, not all, but, you know, but some. And in my case, I didn't know I had to buy textbooks. I didn't know what the word syllabus meant. I had to go look that up the first day of class.
Wow.
I didn't know that, you know, I had to register every semester or what a counselor or advisor was. You know, all of those things that many of us in higher education for all these years, you know, we just take for granted and assume. And so really reminding our teams, and in particular in student services, that every student that walks in our door has that story and background, and it may have taken them months to build up the courage just to come in to ask a question, and guiding through and not assuming that, you know, everybody knows the lingo and the language and the process and the FAFSA. What's a FAFSA? You know, all of those things. So we really work hard to remind ourselves that each student comes to us with unique backgrounds, and support is needed in a variety of ways.
Right. I am reminded of a past Gateway president. I don't think I will name them, but one of the things that this person did very soon after assuming the position of president of Gateway, essentially walked into what would amount to that student services area as though they were just a person coming in wanting to investigate what Gateway had to offer, but in no way identifying themselves as the president of the school. And I thought that was such an interesting idea. And they learned quite a lot, and for the most part were pleased with what they experienced, although there were certain things they thought needed to be different. This is some years ago, just to be clear. This was not Brian Albrecht, well before Brian Albrecht's time. But anyway, I just thought that is such an interesting metaphor, if nothing else, for what you and your staff need to do on a daily basis. That is to try to put yourself into the shoes of somebody who is entering this world for the very first time. And like you said, not knowing some of the very basic things that is so easy for you and I and others to take for granted.
Right. It is good work, and it's challenging work, but we love what we do, and you know, our staff loves serving students.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Stacy Riley, who is one of the vice presidents here at Gateway Technical College. She is the vice president for student services and enrollment. And before we get into this enrollment piece and the specific topic that is kind of central to our conversation, maybe you could just clarify for our listeners what we mean by that big term of student services. I mean, what are kind of the specific components that comprise that sort of service that is extended here at Gateway?
Sure. Student services here at Gateway really spans the spectrum of working with a student who is maybe just thinking about coming to Gateway all the way through to graduation. So we work with our recruitment team, works out in our community with our high schools to really share the value of Gateway, what programming we have available, how do I get started, how do I even know what path I should be on. We have our career and employment services team, which works really diligently with our undecided students. So students who really don't know what they want to do. They might have an idea. They don't know how that kind of equates to programs at the college and degrees. They also work with our employment side. So at the end of a journey, job seeking skills and interviewing techniques and resume writing and connecting with employers for mock interviews or for real interviews, reverse job fairs and reverse career fairs, where the employers come to our students to see and see their showcase of what they've learned in their programs. We also have our bursar's office or student accounts, so our payment plans and scholarship applications and tuition and fees, as well as our financial aid team. So all the financial aid grants and loans and processing is within student services. Additionally, we have academic advising, which is a significant part of our students' journey. How do I, what should I be thinking of that first semester? What's my plan and path from starting my program all the way through to graduation? And then we have our admissions team that works diligently to process our 11,000 applications a year and all the work that goes in with that. And our registrar's team, which is responsible for the integrity of every student record, their grades, their courses they've taken, and transfer credit, or credit for prior learning, which is important for the project we'll talk about today, as well as our commencement and conferring the completion of degrees. And then we have our frontline services, so the first point of contact when you come to campus or call or chat on our website, our contact center. So wide plethora of services and work all the way through from beginning to end.
Wow. And takes probably a small army to make all of that go.
Yep.
Any rough idea of just how many people we're talking about who are involved here in student services?
Sure. I'm at Gateway with student services, and I didn't speak much about the enrollment side. We do have staff who support our customer relationship management systems, our communication with students, and all of those pieces. We have about 95 staff that support our students across the three counties.
Right. And of course, that's the other thing that makes Gateway such an interesting place to work is the fact that there are multiple campuses and serving multiple communities. And that's also such an exciting component of it all.
The other interesting piece that I should note and I'm very grateful for is we employ a relatively good number of student workers. So individuals who are attending Gateway, they work in our welcome center, they work at our in our financial aid office, a variety of offices across our student services area, and it's a great opportunity for professional growth and development. And most recently, we've actually hired three as full-time regular staff that started out as student workers, so that's cool.
Excellent. Very, very good. Well, what prompted this invitation for you to come onto the morning show was an email that you sent out, I presume, to essentially all staff here at Gateway Technical College about a really exciting grant that Gateway received, which involves the re-enrolling of what apparently are called stop-out students. And that's a brand new term to me. I don't remember ever seeing that before. So first of all, explain what we're talking about. What population falls under that heading of stop-out students?
Sure. So stop-out students really simply mean students who attended Gateway at some point but left without earning a degree or prior to earning their credential. You know, and the National Student Clearinghouse Research Center noted that 39 million Americans as of July of 2020 had some college, had earned some college credit, but have not earned a degree. So it's really that population within southeastern Wisconsin and Wisconsin that we're working to address.
Wow. And that's a bigger number than I would have imagined. And I suppose we're talking about stoppage that occurs for all kinds of different reasons.
Yes, it could be any reason, right? Our students, as you mentioned earlier, right, we serve a wide variety of students, age-wise, demographic-wise, background-wise, first generation, many aspects that come along with serving such a diverse student body. So it could be a variety of reasons. It could be, you know, work-related, family-related, financial-related, all different things.
Sure. And it's interesting, in the email you say something that I think is interesting, that this is, to a large extent, about formalizing work that has already been happening. I mean, long before this grant, of course, Gateway and other schools like it have wanted to try to make connections with those who have not been able to complete their degrees and see about helping them do that. And of course, so it's not that this is, oh my gosh, we need to do this. This maybe makes it possible to do this in maybe a more focused way, more formal way. What kind of difference do you see this making?
Sure, Greg. That's a good point. We, yes, have always wanted to support all of the students that have attended Gateway and work to re-engage individuals who have left for, again, a variety of reasons. And the work that this grant through the Wisconsin Technical College System has allowed, as you mentioned, is to really take this year to formalize what the best approach is. We are partnering with a company called ReUp, and their research has shown that it takes about 56 connections with an individual to help them re-enroll in college after they've stopped out. So the grant has also allowed us to take the opportunity to understand what best connections and work with students and helping them re-enroll, what is really needed, and what are the barriers, how do we address those barriers, and to really do this at scale.
It's interesting. One of the things you mentioned in your email is somebody who is going to be shifting their position here at Gateway in order to really focus on some of this. And so they will be a taking a re-entry navigator position. I just love that turn of phrase, because that really is kind of, I mean, it's about re-entry, of course, and but it's also about navigating whatever that pathway might be. And of course, the fact that that pathway is going to be a little bit different for each person, that makes that an interesting challenge.
Yeah, I think navigator is a great term, right? So Mercedes Duran will be our re-entry navigator, first of its kind here at Gateway, and she will serve as that internal connector, right, and the support to help each individual navigate. Our partner, our partnership with ReUp, they have one-on-one coaching that will be provided, and again, at scale, because we have a high volume of students that can use the support. But Mercedes, as a reentry navigator, yes, helping navigate the many systems and barriers or perceived barriers that students may have to re-enroll. Obviously, for some one reason or another, these individuals were not successful to complete their degree the first time or second time they were here at Gateway. So we really want to be purposeful in providing that support.
Right. So if I understand correctly, this is, are we still very much in kind of a fact-finding phase of this project?
We have actually officially launched last Thursday. So we meet actually with our partner organization this week to understand some initial findings and what they're hearing from students about potential barriers or interest in returning. And so it's exciting. We're in the first couple days of officially reconnecting with many thousands of students to understand how we can help them re-engage with Gateway.
So this partner, ReUp, they have already engaged in at least the majority of this kind of investigative work. Am I understanding that correctly?
Yes, we've worked with them over the last 3 or 4 months to really help them gain knowledge of Gateway, to gain knowledge of all of our great programming to support adult learners, as well as helping us fine-tune who should we be connecting with, what type of students, and who are those students, and where are those students.
Right. And has their investigative work been, I mean, I think they're an organization that works with schools, I assume, across the country.
They do.
So this is a national vendor offering this kind of assistance. And has their investigation been kind of on that scale, or have they investigated this more in sort on sort of a local level? I mean, very specific to Gateway.
Sure. So ReUp, their sole purpose is to empower all adults to thrive in higher education. So this is all that they do. They work with stop-out students, as we just learned about stop-out students, but to re-engage them with higher education institutions. So they have technology, personal connections, an algorithm that helps determine the feasibility of coming back for individual students. So we I've been working with them for about 4 months to provide a lot of data about our students and to help them connect with us and help us understand who's probably the best and most ready to return to Gateway. So they work with about 55 institutions across the country and helped re-engage over 500,000 students already.
Wow. So they have a rather proven track record of success with this.
Yes.
Very, very good. So help us understand what happens from here then. I mean, again, you're in the early stages of this, but what happens from this point in terms of Gateway acting on what you are about to learn?
Yeah, a couple of exciting pieces. I mean, it's all exciting actually for me, being in student services and enrollment and really knowing the value of technical education. So I'm always excited to have students recognize and achieve their goals. But I think with the grant that we've been provided, I'm really excited to learn from our partner REUP about the specific barriers and challenges that students are facing related to re-engaging with Gateway. Because then we can take that information and address our programming and our policies and so forth. I'm excited that we've been able to adjust a couple of our programs, one called Fresh Start, which is a debt forgiveness program. Hmm. So we've been able to align that to really support individuals who may have previously had a debt with the college for some reason and help them re-enroll. This gives us an opportunity to re-emphasize and put a highlight and limelight on our Adult Promise program, so Promise to Finish program, which provides funding for returning adult students. So those are really exciting. The other piece the grant has allowed us to do is to provide technology support for students. So laptops, we can provide, we'll purchase and provide laptops for students to really knowing that technology is important to be successful in their time here at the college, as well as helping with enrollment-related costs. So a number of our programs require criminal background checks or immunizations or physicals or medical document managers. We're able to provide financial support for those aspects as well. So really looking to be able to understand how to best support this population of students to really get them re-engaged. We know one way to impact social and economic mobility, you know, is through education and in particular post-secondary degree attainment. So that's something Gateway is committed to.
Very good. So if people want more information about some of these changes about anything that we have talked about, what would be your advice for them in terms of kind of where to go with their questions?
Sure. So Student Services is amazing, and you would be welcome and encouraged to just visit our website. You can call our 800 number at the bottom. You'll be connected to our contact center, and they would be able to get you connected to our experts internally. Happy to discuss that. Anybody can give me a call as well, or drop me an email, rileys@gtc.edu, if there's additional questions.
Very good. Stacy Riley, Vice President for Student Services and Enrollment here at Gateway Technical College. This has really been fun, really been interesting. Best wishes to you and all of your staff and all of the good work that you're doing on behalf of students and future students here at Gateway. Best
Great.
Wishes.
Thank you so much, Greg.
You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. For part two of today's program, we're going into the Morning Show archives for a conversation from 2018 with Lee Berman and Jeremy Bernard, two former White House social secretaries. Lee Berman served in the administration of George W. Bush, and Jeremy Bernard served in the administration of Barack Obama. And together, they have written a book called Treating People Well, The Extraordinary Power of Civility at Work and in Life, published by Scribner. One of the intriguing things that is said early in the book, Treating People Well, is that the White House is, in a sense, two things at the same time. It is this place of sort of majestic importance in our political life, and yet it's also a party venue. I mean, it's a real place. It's a real building. I wonder if you could just say a word about how sort of keeping those two realities in balance was one of the more challenging aspects of the work that you each did as social secretary for the White House.
Well, it always felt like you were going to work, but you were also working in and out of someone's home. And so there were events throughout the day. They weren't just parties. There were press statements and press conferences, or the president might have an announcement or an address to the nation. Anything that happened at the White House, whether it's been in the mansion or in the Rose Garden or South Lawn, was the responsibility of the social office. The only exceptions were the press room and the Oval Office. So it was constant change from one event to the other. Some days we'd have four events, some days we might have one. but it became so common, in a sense, for there to be constant change that it was fairly easy to adjust to that. And it's like everyone, people have their homes, and they are in part for entertaining, and they are part for their living spaces that are private.
Early in the book, you write, it's not easy to keep friends on the other side of the aisle in Washington, where people's careers and success are often built on the fortunes of the political party they serve. In Washington, your politics are your living and your identity. You are from different sides of the political aisle, at least in terms of the presidency that you served. Lee, you served President George W. Bush and his wife, Laura. Jeremy, you, of course, served President Obama and his wife, Michelle. How is it that the two of you met and became friends? And what did it feel like to collaborate, in a sense, across the aisle on this book?
We met because all of the former social secretaries have kind of a loose group who meet regularly and get to know each other and offer our help and support and advice to whoever the current social secretary is, which is how Jeremy and I met. But, you know, we remain friends because the social secretaries have always understood that we want to put our best foot forward from the White House, and it doesn't matter who the president is. So we understand the need for working together. And it's part of how we came to the idea of writing the book. We want people to understand in their everyday lives that things have become too partisan in many cases, and we don't have to have politics in everything. And in fact, when we insist on injecting politics into every situation, all we're doing is making an enemy out of someone who simply has a different point of view.
As part of the book's introduction, you say the Bushes and the Obamas were more similar than one might think. What were you getting at there? What were the most important similarities between those two couples and in a sense, then, between your relative respective experiences in working with them?
Well, I think it, in part, that they both had families. They, the Bushes had two daughters, as did the Obamas, living at the White House. And so they had to balance having a very public life and a very private life that did not make it too overwhelming or too much of a public focus on their daughters. And at the same time, they both wanted people, no matter which side of the aisle they were or what their beliefs were or where they were from, to feel welcomed and to bring as many people into the White House, especially those that had not been before, in. So they both had kind of the same, very different political views, but the same outlook on how people should be treated and how they should welcome people, and we should welcome people into the House.
We're speaking with Lee Berman and Jeremy Bernard about their book, Treating People Well, The Extraordinary Power of Civility at Work and in Life. Lee Berman, you tell us that that you worked early on for actually Vice President Cheney and for a time for his wife as well before shifting over to become the Social Secretary of the White House. And you tell us that that was actually a very dramatic shift. I don't remember exactly the words, but I think it was to the effect that becoming White House Social Secretary was like landing on an alien planet. What was most dramatic about that shift, which to an outside observer might not seem to be actually all that dramatic?
Well, there were actually two shifts. I had been a full-time mom for 10 years when I went to work for the Cheneys, and I went from being in the carpool line one day to being in the White House and learning how to use White House email and the security measures required by the Secret Service and moving Mrs. Cheney and things that I'd never even thought of before in my life. And once I got that under my belt and I worked for the Cheneys for several years, I left government and I thought I was finished. And then I ended up being back at the White House working for the Bushes. And there is an enormous difference between the vice presidential operation and the presidential operation. People working on the vice presidential side tend to sort of move under the radar. People don't pay as much attention. There's not as much scrutiny. When you move over to the presidential side, then all of the staff, the women, and mostly women and some men who worked in the East Wing, have to be very conscious of everything they do because they are a reflection of the First Lady. And so it changes your attitude about how you do things, and you think about things very carefully because you don't want to embarrass them or do something that would be stupid. And so that is part of why it was such a big change, and it's also much more visible.
Mm. Jeremy Bernard, your appointment as White House Social Secretary was noteworthy in a couple of different ways. If I understand correctly, you were the first male to be appointed to that position, and you were also the first openly gay person to hold that position. I think quite a lot has been said about the latter, and you're welcome to say what else you want to say about that. But in some ways, I'm even more intrigued by the first part, the fact that you were the first male ever appointed to that position. I wonder, going into the position, did you have much sense that that was noteworthy and headline news in the way that the other matter was? And do you think that made much difference in the way that you were received?
I do not believe it made much of a difference of the way I was received. I think it, because it was noteworthy and it was something that the press wrote a lot about at the time, it was a little bit more in, you know, it was a little more obvious. It was a little bit more out there. But from the moment I got in the White House, I didn't think about that. I didn't think about, oh, this is always an office that was, you know, occupied by a woman. I didn't think about anything other than putting my nose to the grind and going to work. I wanted to keep a low profile. There had been enough PR about my getting the job. Now I wanted to get the work done, and to, because it wasn't about me and it wasn't about what I did. It was about implementing the Obama's vision of what the White House should be.
One of the intriguing metaphors that you use in the book to describe the heart and soul of your duties within the four walls of the White House was when you said, we were old-fashioned beat cops. Explain what that metaphor is all about. That's certainly intriguing.
Well, the social secretary is almost like a housekeeper in someone's house, and she feels responsible for, or he feels responsible for, everything that they see that's going on. And so I would sometimes find myself standing in the diplomatic reception room minutes before a foreign state arrival ceremony saying, Mr. Vice President, you stand there. Secretary of State Rice, will you please go behind him? And lining them up, you know, like a teacher in a classroom. And they'd go out, and 1 minute later I would be down on my knees on the red carpet pulling up a piece of lint that had appeared from somewhere. Wherever there was a problem, our job was to fix it and not to waste time blaming or figuring out what happened, just fix it. And the object was to keep things as smooth as possible because we cared very much about our guests having a wonderful, memorable experience.
I appreciated the fact that you said at one point that working in the White House was not all ruffles and flourishes. And I think that's one thing that you do a really good job of doing in the book, is to, in a sense, take us behind the scenes and really acquaint us with the nuts and bolts of the work that you were doing, and helping us understand that part of what you were doing was, in a sense, to make it look easy and effortless and flawless. But the only way to do that was to work tremendously hard. I suppose that explains why people tend not to hold these positions for all that long. It has to be a grueling sort of grind, I should think.
It certainly is, and it's obviously an honor, and it was a thrill. And with that, it was also exhausting because you were kind of always on call. And but I think one of the things we wanted to really make clear was that we had the various problems, political, not in the political sense, but there's politics in every job. And there's dealing with different people and how to deal with them. And that our experiences really are not any different than other anyone else's and everyone else's that's out there working or raising a family. It's that ours happened to be at the White House, and there was a more emphasis on it or more focus on it, but that the things that we came across, the issues we found, and the things we learned are very similar to those of someone that works at, whether it be a movie studio or a corporate office or a small business, that many of the issues that we dealt with are similar to anyone else's in their job, and it, for them, it's just as important as it was for us in our job.
Hmm. You outline in your book, Treating People Well, 12 hallmarks of what that really, really means. And I think a lot of people reading your fascinating book will be surprised that the list starts with confidence. Begin with confidence. And it's something you explore at great length. Explain why confidence is at the heart of treating people well.
I think it's hard to do very much in life without beginning with confidence. You know, you can't take charge, you can't radiate calm or manage conflicts if you don't have a certain level of self-confidence. And so we think that having a positive attitude and making an open-hearted approach to things is a great way to build that confidence. We also found that being very well prepared for whatever we were about to do gave us confidence because we'd spent enough time visualizing what we thought was about to happen and preparing for what might go wrong so that if it did, we could manage it quickly. And then finally, we saw how important it was to receive reassurance from the first ladies and the presidents that we worked for, and they were very good about doing that. And the reassurance gave us confidence, and then we tried to always pay that forward with the people we worked with so that they knew when we were working together and having long hours and getting kind of tired that we trusted them, we counted on them, and we knew we had each other's back.
Mm. I appreciated that this chapter takes the time to differentiate between confidence and arrogance, because, of course, we tend to see a whole lot of the latter and maybe not as much of the former. And part of what you are talking about, of course, means understanding the difference. In your minds, what is the most significant difference between being confident and being arrogant?
I think that being confident is understanding, feeling good about the job you do and that you're capable of doing it, and understanding that it is not you alone and it's with other people and that you are part of a team all working together. Arrogance is the feeling of the overconfidence. Arrogance is the feeling that I'm the best at this, I can do it on my own, and I don't need anyone else. It's so easy to detect. It seems like it'd be a fine line, but it's so easy to detect in someone that is confident and someone else that is arrogant. They're both kind of start at the same place, but one goes way, way further in overconfidence in becoming so full of oneself that you don't build confidence in others. The only thing you do is build yourself up, whereas real confidence, not just is confidence in yourself, but building it in other people and making them feel confident.
Right. That reminds me of the story, Lee, that you tell about the moment when First Lady Laura Bush decided to entrust you with approving the daily menu at the White House, something which the chief usher told you had not been done in recent memory, and that was such a powerful gesture of confidence in you.
It was, and it built such great loyalty in me to her. I was so surprised and grateful. It showed that she trusted me, and it showed other people on the staff that she trusted me, because, you know, the White House resident staff is a bureaucracy. They are wonderful people who stay through each president. Many of them have multiple generations of family members who serve in the White House, and any organization like that has a way of doing things. So a new person coming in might not always be listened to the way someone who's been there and been more established. And by showing her confidence in me, she helped the rest of the people that I worked with every day to see that it was okay to trust me and it was okay to listen to what I was asking them to do, because they weren't really requests for me. They were requests coming from her through me.
Hmm. One of the points on this list of 12 involves humor and the fact that humor can often be a very important factor in making situations better and can help us make us more resilient and better at handling challenges. Jeremy, you especially spend a lot of time talking about the way in which you used humor. And sometimes I should think in fairly daring fashion from the way you describe it. Just say a word about what a powerful tool humor was and what a tool it can be when we use it well.
Humor, in that again, is another example of where confidence is so important, because you need to have confidence in having the humor before you can go out there and feel like you're going to be humorous if you're not confident about it. But I think that it is really a key to putting others more at ease, especially in a tense or a stressful situation. And I saw my father, as I was growing up, use humor at difficult times to ease a certain tension. He wasn't making fun of the situation or belittling it, but it made everyone feel a lot less tense. And it's one of the things I found most effective, both with my staff and with the President and First Lady. Now, I was lucky. I'd gotten to know the Obamas at the very beginning of the campaign in 2007, so I had a comfort level with them. But I think it's no matter what workplace and what situation, you have to read it well and know that it's what you're saying isn't going to be offensive, but that self-deprecation, especially, is often a way to make people feel more at ease.
Right. I wish we had more time. I want to spend our last minute or so talking about what I am probably thinking about the most out of your whole book. It's when you talk about your fourth point, listen first, talk later, when you write, "We live in a world of constant communication, but lackluster learning." What is your advice to help all of us, whatever we do, even if we don't live in the White House or work in the White House, how can we do better in listening with care?
I think we all need to slow down. I'm not sure that many of us realize this, but our brain moves so much faster than someone speaks. So if you're standing there talking to your boss and he's telling you something he wants you to do, while you're listening, you're also thinking, here's what I'm going to do. Here's how I'm going to respond. I wonder what I should have for lunch. And I really have to get to the dry cleaners after work. And it's very hard to focus in because our brains work so fast. So if you can discipline yourself a bit to slow down and just listen to what someone is saying, give yourself a chance to think about it before you respond. And, you know, pausing before you answer is just a matter of showing some thoughtfulness. And then answer and take your time. We don't need to race through life as we do because we miss so much. And when you're trying to have real communication with someone and really build up a relationship, you have to listen. You have to look between the lines and see that, you know, perhaps they aren't saying exactly what they mean, but they're hoping that you'll figure out what they really mean. So it just takes a lot more attention.
Well, you certainly had great role models, both of you, in the way you were listened to by the respective first ladies with whom you worked. And your story is just full of amazing accounts of all that you did and experienced in your time in the White House. The book, again, is Treating People Well, The Extraordinary Power of Civility at Work and in Life, published by Scribner. The co-authors, Lee Berman and Jeremy Bernard. I thank both of you for writing this fascinating and inspiring book and for joining me today on The Morning Show. I was honored to speak with you.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you for having us on.
Coming up on Friday's morning show, Bob Glauber's book, Guts and Genius, the story of three unlikely coaches who came to dominate the NFL in the 1980s.